Want to do a quick introduction first and thank everyone for coming. My name is Pablo, and the reason why they set this session up for me is that they're doing a Palestine Israel week, as many of you know. They didn't have a session on refugees. And I've spent the last, 2004, so 7 years, four of those working with refugees. And the first three I was in Guatemala, and I worked for an organization called Acción Cultural Guatemalteca, or Cultural Action Guatemala, which worked with refugees in the Mexican refugee camps after the 36-year Civil War. And the organization was formed in order to help those refugees come back to Guatemala. Many people were killed, 250,000 were killed, and many had to flee and were dispossessed and take off from their homelands during this time. So that organization was formed in 1989 in Mexico, helped the refugees come back and resettle, and then the refugees said, well, now what? And so they changed into a community development organization. And at that point, a couple years down the road, I came along and worked as a youth and communications coordinator. After working as a youth and communications coordinator with this refugee organization, I decided to go to grad school. And I went to graduate school in Brattleboro, Vermont, at the School for International Training. And I got my master's degree in sustainable development. And while I was there, I met a man named Zia, who was a Palestinian refugee. And he was the only Palestinian I had ever met at that point. And I was also co-president of the student body. And in about April of our year there at SIT, the whole Palestine-Israel thing blew up. Somebody sent an email out to everybody, and it said, you know, gave all this pro-Palestinian propaganda. The pro-Israel people came out, and the pro-Palestinian people came out, and it was this big mess. We had a month left of school. And they brought this to the student government, and I sat there and I said, my whole focus in my life has been Central America. I mean, I've done that for years. My parents have been involved in the Central American thing for years and years. I grew up going to protests around the buildings in Chicago where we'd sing, you know, give Nicaragua a chance, send Reagan back to the ranch. Central America was my focus. But I had this great friend, Zia, who we were always just relaxed. We always sat and we chatted about everything under the sun. And so I went out and I sat and I chatted with him that night after this whole thing had blown up. And I said, Zia, I don't know what to do. Here I am, I'm co-president, and there's a bunch of people having these arguments. And I can foster a dialogue. I can talk to people about how we need to figure out how to get along. But what I'm seeing is a lot of people who have never been to Palestine or Israel, who have heard all these things that have happened, and who are having a lot of opinions that I don't know whether they're what they're founded in. What can I do? How can I understand what's going on? Because I don't know anything about it. You know, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, except for what you've talked to me about. And see how it looked at me, and I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do in my field work. He looked at me and he said, you're going to come work for me. And then you're going to work. Ziad co-founded and was the co-director of the largest community development organization in a Palestinian refugee camp. If any of you have any connections to Palestine, you may have heard of the Ibda Cultural Center. It is located in Dehesha Refugee Camp, which is 12,000 people living in less than a square kilometer, actually less than half a square kilometer, I think the video will show you, of space. And so, what was it? 2 months later, I had a plane ticket, I had a job, I had a place to stay. I didn't have a paying job. Too long it's taken. And I went to live in 2007 in Dehesha. And I worked there again as a youth and communications coordinator. I also ended up coaching basketball and winning a national championship. Strange things happen in places where I go, but again, it was working with Palestinian refugees. But I think the first point I wanted to make was my work there, with the support of Ziad, was not just to sit in Palestine and form my opinions from there. He said, go to Israel. Go talk to people there. And so I did. I spent time, I worked with youth on a kibbutz. I met frequently with an Israeli guy who was he worked in the English media, so he would take the Hebrew papers and translate them into English so people could read them. I spent a lot of time in Jerusalem. I went a little bit around the area and got a chance to see and meet with people from Israel, and especially because my master's thesis was written on what were the possibilities for using media to connect Palestinian and Israeli youth, since they could not meet legally. You know, Palestinians and Israelis are not legally allowed to meet. Again, it was talked about in Ellie's session that Israelis cannot go into Area A, which is where most of the Palestinians are, even though there's this nice little wall, and on one side you've got Israel and Palestine. So that was an interesting piece, was the ability to get to go and see with my own eyes, but also to see both sides. But I have to say my bias is on the side of the Palestinian refugees, mostly because I spent a large amount of my time there. I lived there. I went through a lot of the military. I have a lot of stories about the military coming into the camp. I have a lot of stories about going through checkpoints. I know Ellie's doing a session on that as well, for those of you that have been going to her things. So I might talk a little bit about that when she has her session, if necessary. But again, my bias is a little on the side of the Palestinians. Even though I have Palestinian friends, I have Israeli friends. So, Palestinian refugees. Again, as has been pointed out in other sessions, there are now 4.7 Palestinian refugees. And 4.7 million, excuse me. And it started out with about 700,000. That happened in 1948, 1967, when you've got the two different wars, 1948, the catastrophe on Nakba, 1967, the Six-Day War, where Israel took over. It's a very complicated issue to look at. And to start off, what I'd like to show you is Zia, because he's the one who has changed my whole perspective on life and has taught me a lot of things. And one of those things that was really important was that you need to see and understand what's going on before you form opinions. Now, that's not always possible. And so I always thought, one of the great things that I got to do while I was out there was I got to tell other people's stories. And so a couple of things we're going to get to see today is one, a short piece that Ziad did that's a part of a longer piece. And then I actually did an entire 15-minute video on the fact that youth in Palestine inherit the title of refugee. And it's so much better to hear their voices and to have them tell the story about the refugee and what we call refugeehood. Actually, if you search for refugeehood, it is a title. It is a word that, again, refers to the fact that Palestinian refugees can inherit the title throughout their lives. And so the video is called Refugeehood, the Inheritance. I'll take
it. Yeah, I'm curious now. What do the refugees do in these camps?
I was going to tell you a lot about that.
Okay.
And so that's my thing, was trying to humanize at least a little bit of the part of what the refugees do. The video shows you 2007, when I was there. I am still in contact with a lot of them. I've seen a bunch of them lately. Ziad lives down the street from me in Oakland. He's doing his master's work at the Middle East Children's Alliance, and so he's been working there for years. So when he knew I moved to Oakland, he said, "I'm going to find a place in Oakland." And so he's right up the street from me. We never see him because he's always out speaking. He's met my son, Sebastian, who's not quite in here yet, once, even though he calls himself Uncle Ziad. Make sure that he's going to teach him about social justice. Let me introduce you to Ziad, and then we'll play the video, and if that doesn't answer your question about some of the things that are done, I can talk a lot about what the refugees do in the camp. I can talk about what the refugees do in the Dehesha refugees. That's a very important piece, is that my experience, while I have been to other refugee camps, and while I have spent time all over Palestine, I had to travel for basketball, interesting story, is still specifically related to the Dehesha refugee camp, which has a unique story because of the community organization IBDA, which means to create something out of nothing, which they did through a dance crew that you'll get to see as well. Culture and life is very important to the Palestinian refugees, as is a number of other things, including the right of return, which I'll talk about right after I show Ziad's piece. Somebody wants to hit the lights.
Actually, I was born Nazis.
I am Christian, I am from the transformation.
The room's lifted and I am struggling not to die.
I am doing my practical in Bethlehem at the Hishu refugee camp, and I'm studying conflict and transformation.
I was born in the Hishu refugee camp. I grew up here and I am struggling not to die here. Actually, I was born in 1964, and one of the rooms looks like this. These are the rooms, it was built by United Nations. Even before that period, they were living in tents. But in 1952, the United Nations started to replace the tents by small rooms, by the small rooms. Here we have two rooms. Each room was 9 square meters, and the each size of family, that period, it was 6 people, 4 children and 2 parents. I was born in one of these rooms, and I'm the youngest one in my family. I had 4 brothers and sisters, and my parents, they were 2, we were 7 living in 9 square meters, looks like this exactly, one room, which there's no space to live there, and until mid of 70s when we start extending the house. This is part of the history of the Hesha refugee camp. This is part of the history of the Russian refugees. This is when I speak about my history as a human being. I grew up in this kind of rooms. I opened my eyes in this kind of rooms. Our house was invaded the first time in 1967, was in one of these kind of rooms. I was arrested from this kind of rooms. I was educated in these kinds of rooms. And I'm struggling because I was educated in this kind of rooms and continue my struggle to return back to my homeland.
But I just think it's a...
If you hit the lights real quick. So that's Ziad. Obviously, he's a powerful speaker. I think one of the reasons why he ends up doing a lot of the stuff for his organization is because his English is so good. But he's a journalist. So he spent his life doing stuff like this. He's also spent a lot of his life in prison. He spent 11 years of his life in prison and arrested for many different things. And he's told me some stories about it. And those were never easy to hear. One of the things he mentions there was the first time his house was invaded in 1967. Well, he has told me that story. And actually, the best time I heard that story, I don't know if any of you have seen The King of Scotland, or Last King of Scotland, what's it called? Mm-hmm. So the screenwriter from The Last King of Scotland was sitting on the fourth floor of the Cultural Center where they have a restaurant. And it was 4 of us. And there was his translator, Ziad, and myself. And Ziad told the story of when the Israeli army came into his house looking for his brother. And he remembers that he was asleep, and he heard a noise, and he woke up, and there was a boot in front of his face. And he started to look up, and up that boot, and then he started to see the muzzle of the AK-47. And they kept looking for his brother, who wasn't there. His brother had left. But it's a very powerful memory for him. Now, there are 2 things before we go into the video that are very important. One, Ziad mentioned that in the beginning there were tents in the refugee camp. Those changed into houses. That is important because, for instance, one of the arguments from the Israeli government about why it's no longer a refugee camp, there are no Palestinian refugees, is because there are houses there. They said they built on the houses. They built stuff here. The other reason that is important is because then the Palestinians also have the thing, and the Israelis talk about, well, why did the United Nations lease the land that they built these refugee camps on for 99 years? So they leased that land. So they leased the land, 99 years. Obviously, they thought they wouldn't be there that long, right? But they also built on it. So it makes this really interesting, I think, conundrum of ideas of why did they lease it for that long? And why did they have to end up then building on it? And how does that play into the whole refugee? So obviously, they call it the refugee problem, which we can argue back and forth about whether or not it's a problem, it's an issue, what is it? Now the question was, what do they do in the camps? So again, my favorite part of getting to be there was, this wasn't even around my master's thesis, was I was allowed to go around with Ziad and some others, and we got to talk to people. And that helps to form, you know, my opinions and my ideas about what's going on. And we got a chance to make a video about it. And so I'm going to show you the video about that one, and then we can start a discussion a little bit about the Palestinian refugees. But I wanted you to meet some of them. And of course, I work with youth, so it's all about the youth. So you'll get to see a lot of shots of what they do. And the fact that, you know, even in the midst of some very trying times, again, you saw a picture that you may not have noticed. There was a picture of a gate. It was basically our fence that was really, really large, that an old man was walking down. And Dehesha, for years and years and years, was surrounded, and they were only allowed out at certain points. There was a comment made yesterday about they're fighting a war of the womb, and my Ziad, hope I tell his joke right, would always go, well, of course we're fighting a war of the womb, you know, if they lock us down and we can't leave our houses for, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 days, what do you think we're going to do? He tells it a little differently. That was what it made me think of when somebody brought up that fact that, you know, they were locked down without power, without water, a lot of the times, for hours, for days, for weeks at a time. I think the longest one was like 40-some-odd days they weren't allowed to leave their homes. During the time when Israel controlled those borders. And so, any quick question before I run into the video? The video is very wonderful, and I hope you understand what I'm talking about.
Will you locate Daisha in on the West Bank? Where is that?
So, for anyone who's been there, or if you've not, no matter what, Daisha is right outside of Bethlehem. Bethlehem's about right here, and Daisha is right under, and Jerusalem is up here. So I wished I had all my actual information and was able to have a map ready for you guys to see, but I didn't expect to do a session. So luckily I had a few things with me. So it's right outside of Bethlehem. I actually got lost one day because I went to Bethlehem and I decided to walk home. And I was like, I can walk. It's only like a couple miles, you know. Poland, I used to run all over the place. And I got lost and had a few rocks thrown at me. But it's right outside of Bethlehem. Really, it's about a 5-minute drive to the Church of the Nativity, which I got to spend some really interesting times at. One with a Palestinian woman, which if you ever get to go on a tour of the Church of the Nativity with a Palestinian, you need a very different history, because they will point out the bullet holes from when during the Second Intifada, the Palestinians holed up in there and the Israeli was just shooting around the area, so you can see the bullet holes. And you don't think about those when you walk in, because you walk in, you're in the place where Jesus was going. What else are you going to think about? You're not looking up, you're looking to where you're going, which is down a stairway to the spot where they say the manger was. And if you look up, there's just bullet holes all over the place.
Isn't that a divided church? Isn't it two different churches right there together?
I don't believe so. I feel like everything was kind of the same in that area. I don't think so. I might have to look that one up in terms of whether
the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
What's it?
The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is divided.
Well, that's the one. Okay.
That's in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I also went to with a Palestinian woman on her one-day pass to Jerusalem, only the second time in her life, and she was 25 that she had been allowed to go to Jerusalem. And so I was lucky enough to get to go with her, and we went and toured all the holy places. And I didn't get to go into either of the mosques, because not being Muslim, you're not allowed to go. She went in, but I got to go and see Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock.
You weren't allowed into the Dome of the Rock?
No. I was not allowed. There was specific people standing out making sure. Again, it's a tourist area. And that's a really hard piece. I mean, I got in trouble even over at the wall, the Jewish wall, which has a different name.
Oh, West Wall.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't want me going near that one either because they saw me with the Palestinians. So that was interesting. And I had a camera, and you're not supposed to have a camera anywhere near. So there were a lot of things that happened. Like I said, I have stories probably about everything. Let me play the video. If someone hits the lights again. And if somebody tells me if they can't read, I will read stuff for you as well. Excuse me for a second, because watching some of this stuff brings back a lot of memories, especially the amount of time I got to spend with Abkis and Lana and Adam and Anand. And there are two things I always get when I'm watching the video. One is really the sense of hope and the sense of just incredible strength that those kids have. They are some incredible, they've got to be probably, they're adults now. They were about 15, 16 when I made the video, and I still keep in touch with several of them. Adam and I are Facebook friends. And he checks in all the time about how he's doing in his soccer. He also talks a lot, as you can see. I should have probably mentioned that there's a little bit of reading. And I debated back and forth when making the video is, do I put the translation over or do I just put it at the bottom and let people try and read as much of the words as they can? And it really came down to that their voices, no matter whether you understand the words or not, you can hear in their voices the strength and resolve they have, even having inherited this, how much of a part of themselves being a refugee is, and how much a part of whatever can happen for them is in their minds. This is saying, we would like to return. And of course, those are the big issues for the refugees, is the right of return. And having been asked to this session yesterday after coming to the piece on the history, I went back and started seeing, what do I have on my computer about my time? I did a lot of writing, I made a lot of videos, and so I got to watch some, I did some reading, my wife and I discussed a lot of stuff, because we were in contact every day while I was out. We weren't married at that point, obviously it worked out. Got married and there's a kid. So. But, we talked a lot about it, and the thing that I remember, she reminded me about the 99-year lease, and then the other big thing was, I talked to a lot of refugees about the right of return, because this is a huge piece. And again, just to note that the right of return refers to the Palestinians' right, as stated in, what is it? UN Resolution 194 that says they have a right to return to their land. It's never been actually enforced. But also, that's always been embedded into the Palestinian culture as the right of return when they were forced out, or some of them, if you read a lot of books about Palestine, which I have, you read about how some families just decided to take a little vacation when the war happened and said, we'll be able to come back. Well, they never were able to come back. They took the keys to their house. And that's a big symbol. It's a lot of people. Ziad can show you the key to his family home in Zakaria, which we've stood on land that he could actually go to, given the wall and the restrictions. And we could see Zakaria, over the horizon. And right now, there's nothing on it. A lot of the land is national, they call it national parks, or held for future developments, or etc. So while their houses, a lot of them have been destroyed or are under trees or whatever they want to put up there, those people still hold that piece very dearly in their hearts about the right of return. But the right of return doesn't, for for who I talk to, just mean that they're all going to go back. But they want the right to travel freely. They want the right to be able to go back. Some of them said, I wouldn't go back to my land. My house is here. I'm good here now. I've made a life here. Because some of them don't live. Some of them moved from the refugee camp. They've been able to buy houses in other places around. And then they say, we wouldn't leave. We don't want to pick up and move. But I want the right to be able to go back to my land. I don't want to have to smuggle. A lot of them have been smuggled through to stand on their land, especially from Hibda. They don't want to have to be told that they can't go. And again, that brings, you know, could bring us up to the checkpoint discussion, which again, really doesn't allow you to move. Every time I had to travel for a basketball game in Ramallah, which was the capital of Palestine, which Dehesha was right here, Ramallah was right here, but Jerusalem's right here. So we had to go down through the container, is what they called it, which was where they had this huge checkpoint, and I always had to go through some type of screening. One time I got out of the screening because the guy saw I was from the U.S. and he was like, U.S., you like basketball, Lakers. And I was like, no, Bulls. And he was like, Lakers. I was like, no, Bulls. He was like, okay, you can go. The other time a guy saw I was from the U.S. and he was like, you know, U.S., all respect, we love you. And I was like, yeah, I'm not really sure how I feel about you saying that, considering my money probably bought your gun, but, you know. Another time I did my checkpoint interview in Spanish because it was a Venezuelan Israeli who looked at my passport and said, wow, you've been to Central America a lot. You speak Spanish? And I was like, yeah. So on a bus with 70 Palestinian men, I did a checkpoint interview about what was I doing on the bus, why was I there, you know, all that kind of stuff in Spanish. And later they were like, what did you just do? I just got out of it by not messing up in Spanish the interview. He asked a couple questions. I was like, I just like basketball. This bus said it was going. Those are the easier ones. There were also times with an AK-47 with a grenade launcher soldered onto the bottom of it, pointed at my chest while they asked some questions and checked on where we're going. There was being covered with a, you know, machine gun. While they searched the entire van and took away one of the Palestinians who had a warrant out for throwing rocks at some others. There were a couple other. There was the biggest gun I've ever seen pointed directly at me as I was trying to walk through a checkpoint coming back from Nablus, and here I am sitting in the back telling jokes in Arabic because I thought we should have a lighter mood, and all the people around are just laughing. And then 5 seconds later, the guard comes up and looks at me, and he's like, "American?" I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "You can go this way." And I just had to walk around the checkpoint. Everyone else had to stay probably for hours and hours to sit there. And I was ready to stay for hours and hours, but he was like, no, you have to go this way. So I'm curious, I guess we don't have a lot of time, and I know that questions and discussion is a better piece. I hope I've given some sort of perspective. And I think the other thing about the video that's important, even if you didn't get to read all the words, is to see the images of the camp, which on one hand show the small roads that run through, again, 12,000 people in less than a half square kilometer of area. But then you've got a place like Ibda, which gives the kids an outlet for sports, for dance. It was founded on a dance group that they said, we want to go back and do the dances that show our culture. And that dance group started touring around the U.S. and it's toured around Europe. And it started to bring in money, and they built a cultural center, they built a kindergarten, they started a women's microcredit program.
When did it begin, Paul?
I think 1992. Mm. You remember? Mm-hmm. I think it was 92 was their first year.
Was Ziad involved in it from the beginning?
Ziad and Khalid, teacher Khalid, were the two who founded it. And Khalid is still there, and his kids were in the video in certain places. And when I was there, were workers at Ibda. It's a very community place. It does get into a little bit of trouble because, again, boys and girls hanging out in a Muslim country, and not being the girls not necessarily having to wear the hijab. They made their own decisions on that one, so that got them in trouble for a few things. And as any community organization that grows that big, they have their organizational administrative problems. But again, you see the conditions that they live in the refugee camp, and you see that they're providing this ability for some of the students to express themselves and have an outlet and have that sense of hope. But again, as Palestinian refugees, and that Palestinian refugee population is just going to keep growing, they are embedded with this sense of identity. I found myself questioning my own identity a lot in that time. And so that's a huge piece for the refugees, is their identity as Palestinians and their, you know, ability to return, or the right to return to their lands. Yes,
I know that the refugee camps are pretty close to the other populated areas in the West Bank. Bethlehem is right there, and Beit Jala and Beit Sahur. What's the relationship of the folks who live in the camp to the people who live in those other cities?
You know, the really interesting thing to look at in some of those areas was when we drive and I'd see these huge houses in Bethlehem. I say, wow, that's a big house. And they say, yeah, they have money. That guy's the head of some, you know, car dealership. They have a lot of money. And I said, but then the refugee camp is sitting right there. So some of the time they make it out and are able to get some money. The relationship seems to be one of, we're all one people, but when it comes to, you know, again, some of those Palestinian refugees, so they're all refugees, basically, in that area, it's just, well, I've made my life, I'm good, I can still stay here and do these things. I think the interesting thing is actually brings basketball in a funny way. So IBDA had the only basketball team to come out of a refugee camp. All the other basketball teams were from elite Palestinian organizations. So their basketball players drove BMWs and got paid to play. IBDA players did not. And we won a lot. They didn't like that. Now, they all got along, but they weren't people that hung out together later. Those IBDA players hung out in the refugee camp, and the elite players, you know, they come and talk with us for a few seconds. They especially liked it if they could speak a few words in English to talk to me. But I think that was the relationship that I got to see, was that, you know, everybody in those clubs wanted to be IBDA. They're like, yeah, we're this elite club. We should be able to beat these guys that come from a refugee camp. But it stopped at basketball, and that was kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if you have anything to add or a question.
Oh, I have a question.
Oh, I was going to say, you've been in the matter. You can add if you have any ideas. Well, you can ask the question.
Hey, I still got a question about the...
Can I take her question?
Oh, sure.
Sorry.
This might be outside of your area. I've been up here since the 1st of December, and so I've been trying to keep up with everything that's been happening throughout the Middle East this winter and spring. And I've been really interested, but not able to find a lot of information about these spontaneous, nonviolent border crossing initiatives by Palestinian refugees from the neighboring Arab states crossing into Israel. And I know, obviously, Israel has been very successful in keeping these disparate Palestinian groups separate from each other and blocking communication. And so I'm just wondering if you know if this represents some sort of connection between refugees outside of Palestine, refugees within the West Bank, how they're working together, if this does represent a potential new way forward, another avenue for the nonviolent resistance movement.
I wish I had a good answer for you, but within my continued, I mean, I'm still connected with Ziad when I get to see him, with Mecca, I keep up on all the news and all that, but that has not come across at all to me, so that's going to actually be a really interesting piece for me to go back and look into. I'm wondering, you know, because the majority of my connection right now is with Ziad and with Mecca, which is in the U.S., and Mecca's big piece right now is a water project in Gaza. And so we've been, you know, a lot of stuff I've been donating money and gone to a couple of different events for them because there's no clean water, especially for schools in Gaza. So Mecca, Middle East Children's Alliance, who has been partnered up with IBDA since, I believe, the beginning, has been trying to put these water purification centers and medical supplies. They do all this work in Gaza, and that's actually been where the focus is. So I've unfortunately missed, and then the I've missed any of the other stuff. Well, and then Hamas and reconciling, that's also been on the news, which again brings, you know, it all, that brings up an interesting point of the media coverage. That was such an interesting thing to sit in Palestine and start reading the different media coverage. Mm-hmm. While I knew what had just happened, mm-hmm. or to see what wasn't covered, what, how they were covering certain different things. I mean, there was the visit from, I believe it was Condoleezza Rice, to right outside of Dehesha in Bethlehem. She made this quick across the border, and it was all over. It was like news. Condoleezza Rice visits Palestine, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, no one here knew she was even here. Like, the only reason I knew was because I was driving down the street with Ziad, and we had to turn because they blocked off the street. And I was like, why is the street blocked off? And he was like, somebody from the U.S. is coming. And I don't know, she'll be here for like 5 seconds, say what's up, and go out. So that was a really interesting piece. But, you know, another thing that wasn't covered was while I was there, Martin Luther King III visited Dehesha. And I got to hang out with Martin Luther King III and talk about how our dads, my dad was a civil rights worker and worked with Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights movement. So we have pictures of Martin Luther King in our house hanging out with my dad, and I got to walk up to him and say, hey, my dad hung out with yours. But nobody knew about that whole visit, or, you know, a couple other visits of prominent people who came to Dehesha to talk about what the possibilities were for later. So again, the media, just as you know, that's always the thing for me, is I don't I read the media with about Palestine and Israel with a fine-toothed comb, and I look through and see what I can figure out, and then I write an email message and say, how are things going? Since my connections are still.
What did you discover, Pavel, with your thesis? Was there any aha moments for you in that?
You know, you always think when you write a thesis, especially one as big as I thought mine was, that it's going to come out and everything's going to be positive, and, you know, you're going to ride off into the sunset. And my thesis question was, is it possible to use the media to connect Palestinian and Israeli youth since they can't meet legally and have this time for conversation? And we were able to set up a small conversation between Palestinian and an Israeli youth. That was an Israeli youth who was spending the year in the U.S. It was not possible to do Palestine to Israel because of language. What language would they communicate in? The Palestinians, some of them speak English, but no one spoke Hebrew. No one that I knew of spoke Hebrew, or more than a few words. The Israeli students didn't speak a lot of Arabic. When I went out there, I had to practice my Hebrew. I had a few words. And I did it in English with a translator. There's also a cultural difference. That's probably self-explanatory. But also, not only that, but it's not as big a deal for the Israeli youth. That was a huge thing. They were like, what would the interest be? They're very sheltered from that. And so even when I talked to them, they were like, you're living where? And I don't know. All we know about that is we're not allowed to go there. And, you know, they have terrorists. And I was like, yeah, they're pretty nice people. Not really much going on in that case. And so unfortunately, the end of my thesis said, at this point, it's not possible. But given increased education, the thought to a language piece, and a couple other considerations, it could be possible in the future. But, I mean, I got to go into a lot of detail in order to figure out that that wasn't going to happen. But at the end, I was like, there's no way I can say this is going to happen, given these restrictions that they currently have.
I still got I'm puzzled about, this is a lot about the youth, which is fine. But what do the adults do? Do they have jobs someplace? He said that someone, the one was a car dealer, and he built a big house for himself.
Yeah.
Is that inside the refugee camp? Or
no.
So what happened? Do they travel back and forth to Israel freely, or through checkpoints? Or?
All right. So I'll explain a little bit about that.
So they have jobs somewhere? Or what? I don't know. I just puzzled.
I think that the unemployment rate is somewhere north of 60%, something to that effect. It was, and it was something like that. I heard the number, and it was just astounding. I can't give you an actual figure, but it's high. They are not allowed, unless you have a special permit, you are not allowed to travel to Jerusalem, and that special permit is really not given out very frequently. In order for me to go to Jerusalem, I had to go through a metal detector, you know, I had to answer a bunch of questions, and I did that. I did a lot. I even did it, you know, taking stuff over that I needed to do for people that were on the other side of the wall. There's not a lot of jobs. Israel controls a lot of the money. They control a lot of the stuff that comes in. They control the water. They control the electricity. You know, if I didn't know better, and I'll put it out there, it's kind of a campaign of just despair, of just taking away so that there's nothing left for them to do, that they just give up or go somewhere else. I mean, that was a really hard piece for me, but I mean, the jobs that they had, I had, you know, a friend, one of the guys who played for me on the basketball team, incredible point guard, could dribble the ball and shoot the ball with both hands all over the place. He worked at a little wood carving bracelet making factory. I had one guy who had a Jerusalem permit, who worked for the Red Cross, and he had five kids and was 6'4", 250. And so he had that one job. I had one guy who worked for a car dealer, but he wasn't the head. He like helped sell. And his family no longer lived in Dehesha. They lived on the outside, closer to the Nativity Church.
How do they leave the camp?
The camp no longer has a fence around it. So it had a fence around it for, I believe, 12 years. And that had one gate and one door. Actually, I have a picture of me going through the gate. The gate is still there. The fence is no longer there. So they can come in and out. But, for example, in order for them to go to places like get to an airport and leave, they have to go to Jordan. And it takes them a very long time. Because they have to go across a bridge. They have to go through one checkpoint. They have to go through another checkpoint. They have to go through the Jordanian. They have to go through the Israeli pieces. So for anyone to get out, you have to go through a specific way. Again, to go anywhere within Palestine, we had to go through different checkpoints to go. They could probably travel about, I would say, 10 to 15 minutes outside of Dehesha before they got to a checkpoint that they would have to go through. And it would depend upon the day as to whether or not they were allowed to go. You may have heard, this sometimes makes it into the news, but not often, that in a lot of the places like, I'm blanking on its name, but I went there, which is, it's three-fourths of this town is enclosed by the wall, and so there's only one small spot for them to get out that's only open at certain times, and in terms of medical emergencies, they have turned people away who have then died because they just said, no, you can't go out at this time in terms of women giving birth or any other type of medical emergency. And we actually, the only way we could get into that town was we had to walk through the checkpoint. They wouldn't let us come in the taxis. Actually, we weren't even in taxis, we were in buses at that point. I went with another group that came from the Middle East Children's Alliance to go see, I'm blanking on the name of this group that's connected, but again, travel, it's really hard. And so again, that the whole point that they want is that freedom of travel. And so if you talk about one state, two state solutions, well, given how Palestine is broken up with settlements and settler roads and checkpoints and control right now, the ability to have a two-state solution would require such a change in the makeup of the country that it would take a very, very long time. So, I mean, kind of answers in one way. I saw your hand.
Could you explain why in the video as well as a little description on the schedule, it says that Palestinian refugees are the only people who are referred to as the status of a refugee. Maybe I don't understand.
Sorry, they're the only people who can inherit the status. So anyone else who's become a refugee, they became a refugee at that time, and their children did not inherit the title.
Okay.
I looked this up several times because we had talked about it before. I made that statement because I was like, I don't want to make a statement and then like, have to take it back.
Well, so what does that mean? They can inherit it and other people can't.
So, for example, in Guatemala, there were roughly, boy, I can't remember the number, but we'll just say 40,000 who became refugees during the Civil War, who were internally displaced, or that was the word, I used a different word, internally displaced, or ended up in Mexico, or Honduras, or El Salvador, one of those different countries. They were refugees. Their children were not. In terms of how we think about refugees, and how, in terms of how they're categorized, and how, in terms of you can register as a refugee with the United Nations. Palestine, for some reason, it is set up so that there were originally 700,000. That total has swelled to 4.7 million because their children are then registered as refugees. This is just registered. I should also point that out. It's 4.7 registered. There are a lot more Palestinians in the world.
So what's the benefit of registration? I mean, do they get any stipends?
So, again, one of the things you asked about, someone asked about jobs. Mm-hmm. Well, again, the United Nations is active in these Palestinian refugee camps. One of the shots that was in here was a UN truck with food and supplies that was in there. So if you are registered with the UN, and again, you don't have a job, you are still getting food, medical. They have UN schools in the refugee camps. And so that is one of your major benefits, is that you are still able, and your children are able to register for those things.
And your children's children.
And your children's children. So there is a benefit towards that. It's just an interesting phenomenon. I call it a phenomenon, because why did they set it up? One, why did they lease the land for 99 years? Two, why did they set it up so that the children of the original refugees could inherit? What was the thinking behind that? I'm still working on that question. I'm sure a lot of people are still working on that question.
It sounds very similar to the Dodd rolls when they dealt with Native American tribes, and it's like a similar type of thing. Why did they register those kids or those families so that down the line they knew that wasn't going to be a temporary thing, it was going to be a permanent thing?
And that would be a really interesting comparison to make, and quite an astute point to make here.
So what's the future, do you think?
I've been asked that question before. I don't have an answer. I think that there are a lot of things that need to happen in order for anything to make sense. There's one other point that I need to take the questions for that one. But to make on that is that it's a really interesting thing that I noticed, was that if you talked to, you know, one of the regular Palestinians, they had the right of return, they had all this sense of Palestinian identity, but it was really the extremist groups that got all the press and that were the ones that defined within the media and for the rest of the international world, unless you weren't, you know, just glued to a TV, you were actually out learning about some of this stuff. What that population was and what they wanted. And it's kind of the same if you go to Israel. There are a lot of really good people in Israel who are there because there was, you know, something horrible happened. They needed a place to live. And somebody made a decision that it was going to be here and it was going to displace some other people. But they live their lives, you know, simply. They live their lives very easily and they're not involved. Now there's the extremists and the settlers who have decided that there's some other piece, that something else that is due them, and therefore they're, you know, starting to cut up, and they want to push all the people away and protect themselves so that, again, something like the Holocaust doesn't happen again. And I'm completely for the Holocaust not happening again. But I am questioning of how oppressing another people after you've been oppressed is an answer to your problem. And I don't know what the answer is, but I am sure, and Zion would say this as well. He's like, you know, I'm not against the Israelis. I'm against the idea that some in Israel have put forth that we need to be pushed out or exterminated. And it actually has been said that by some of the higher-ups in Israel that the Palestinians need to be exterminated. I read that and I was like, really? Did he know what he was saying? in that case. So I think that's a that's an interesting. Let me take the last two questions, then it's best person.
Yeah.
I could talk about this for a long time.
What are Arab nations, especially wealthy ones like Saudi Arabia, doing? Is anything happening? You know, like we reach out to the whole world to try and help.
Well, again, you're gonna run into right there is the U.S. interests, and that's a whole nother topic of how the U.S. interests and the U.S. investment and the U.S. support of Israel filters around to all of the places around. You know, U.S. has investments in Saudi Arabia. No one is going to do anything against.
So it's not politically correct
for
them.
Yeah, it's not. No one in of the Arab nations who is aligned with the U.S. or even not aligned with the U.S. is going to do something, because again, Israel has nuclear weapons. They have a much higher, even in that small area, military than any of the countries that are around. And I mean, the whole thing is just, it's a political mess in that sense. And so I believe at one point, you know, this whole thing that's going on right now with Egypt opening the Rafah crossing into Gaza is really interesting. Now, it hasn't done a lot. I believe only like 300 people have been allowed through, was the last news I read. Because I'm watching this one, because I was like, you know, so there are two crossings into Gaza. One is from Israel into Gaza, and one is from Egypt into Gaza. And they've all been, you know, shut off because they have the blockade on Gaza. So there's tunnels that go in, and they'll find the tunnels, and they'll collapse them, etc. Well, Egypt decided to open up theirs in defiance of Israel, and kind of defiance of the U.S. as well. Who was, you know, claiming that since Hamas runs Gaza, the democratically elected Hamas runs Gaza, that it's a terrorist place. So they shouldn't be allowed to receive supplies. Well, Egypt has opened it up. So if you're interested in looking at how an Arab state is trying to kind of push a little bit, I would recommend that you go and look up some articles and read on what Egypt's doing, because I'm keeping a close eye.
Well, this is just kind of a point of clarification, something that I didn't understand until I was there. When I think of refugee camps, I think of citizens of another country residing in another country. And here, Dehesha is a Palestinian refugee camp inside of Palestine. So when you're asking where are the jobs are in Bethlehem, the jobs are in Al-Khalil. These are places that you're not trapped inside the camp. Leaving Dehesha does not require you to cross an international border. So that was something that I didn't get my mind wrapped around until I saw it. This, of course, I'm not saying that travel is unrestricted in Palestine. It can be very difficult to get to your job. But you can walk outside of your house and get on a bus and get to the city center of Bethlehem without too much trouble, for the most part. So I don't know if this is...
But you can't get outside of Bethlehem, Beit Zohur, or Beit Jala...
Because of the wall.
...to go to Jericho, where your family, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
So you're now contained, maybe not within a half square kilometer, but within a
exactly.
Square
yes.
mile.
So that is
I mean, so you're limited, that's it.
Is that now that fence is gone, and the military patrols only come in when they're looking for people, or just to... Occasionally, I think it was to rile people up a little bit. They'd come in and throw noise bombs and start shooting. Those were always fun mornings at 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
I'd call my mom, and my mom would go, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. Just wondering what's going on." And I did call her after the worst one, after there was an assassination in Bethlehem, and I was there. And then they started to riot at, I'm forgetting names, but they rioted at the point right near where the assassinations had taken place, and I was coming back from somewhere, and I was about to get in a taxi, and all these people started converging with knives and sticks and rocks and stuff. To like, it was the assassination of four youth who were involved in some politics. And the guy looked at my taxi and said, "That taxi needs to go. Get out of here." And it took off. We left the rioting masses as they were coming together. In that case. But again, I think the biggest point, and I'll leave you with this, was that knowing what is going on and getting to see it, as was just pointed out, without knowing and understanding the travel restrictions, without being there, it's and not relying just on the media, looking at other places to find your information, is so important in understanding what's going on, what's happening to the people there, and And also continuing to know that they're regular people with hopes and dreams and ideas and talents, mm-hmm. and it's an incredible group who have a sense of identity that, again, made me question my own sense of identity, because I was trying to figure out, who am I when these people have this belief in themselves? I mean, I spent a fraction of my life there in comparison to some of the other places I've spent, and that place changed me more than anything else. And it's, you know, the reason why I continue my work. I now am a second grade teacher in East Oakland, and I work with a different kind of refugee population. I'll put it that way. It's all of my students are. Well, what to say? All of my students are special. So it has different ideas. And so everything that I've learned goes into that kind of work that I do now. But again, Palestinian refugees are incredible people. If you get a chance to chat with one, they will talk to you. And no matter, it doesn't always have to be in a language that either of you understand. It is an incredible piece and an incredible part of the world that has a lot of conflict, but a lot of hope and a lot of love. So, thank you all for coming.